Welcome back to New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Patterson, and today we'll be talking with Heather Schoenfeld about her new book, Building the Prison State: Race and the Politics of Mass Incarceration. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for having me.
Can you first tell us a little bit about yourself?
Of course. So I am an associate professor in sociology at Boston University. I actually just started that position. And previous to that, I was an assistant professor at Northwestern University, where I actually got my PhD as well in sociology.
Great. How did this book come about for you?
So mass incarceration is something that I have been thinking about since the late 90s, really. Now mass incarceration is becoming much more of a household word and a social problem that people are aware of. But back in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was not something that people talked about, let alone really understood. And so I came to the problem of mass incarceration really through the problem of racial inequality, and with the understanding that the criminal justice system was one site in which racial disparity was so stark and so problematic for people's life chances. And so the project came about in wanting to understand, how did we get to this place? How did we become the country that incarcerates the most people per capita? How did we come to invest so much in prisons and put so many people behind bars? And I felt that the best way to understand that was to tell a story at the state level. So if we look at where people are incarcerated in this country, two-thirds of them are in state prisons. We often hear a lot about national policy, but the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of people are behind bars in either state prisons or local jails. And so this project looks at the state level to try to understand what are the politics and the policies that created this prison state, as it were.
So let's start with your method. Oh, go ahead.
So that's sure. So methods. So this is a project that required a lot of different methods, both historical methods, so archival research, mainly done in Florida, in state archives, some private archives of lawyers. It also involved media content analysis. And because I was dealing with recent history, so my original research goes back to the 1950s, I was able to do interviews with people who were key decision makers during the story I tell. And the story in the book goes from the 1950s to the current time period. And so those interviews were key in terms of understanding some of the behind the scenes in decisions that were made and some of the thinking of policymakers and other actors that is not always clear from the archival record.
Great. And you focus specifically on Florida. Why Florida?
Yes. It's funny now because in a way, don't have to answer that question, and that Florida has become, has been in the news for its criminal justice issues more recently. If we think back to Trayvon Martin not so long ago, the acquittal of George Zimmerman and Stand Your Ground laws. Florida is this kind of key player in sparking the criminal justice debate in this the nation more at large. But what is less known is that Florida has really played that role for quite some time. So we can think back to a number of lawsuits having to do with really the punitive nature of Florida criminal justice. So in the 1950s, there were lawsuits from people who had escaped Florida chain gangs and didn't want to go back to Florida, right? And judges in places like Chicago were saying, you know, we don't have to send you back. This is cruel and unusual punishment. Two court decisions in the 1960s that represented folks who had not received the assistance of counsel in felony criminal cases. So Gideon versus Wainwright, Gideon was a Florida state prisoner, and this case went to the Supreme Court and established the right of assistance of counsel that we know of today. In the 1980s, there was Florida v. Bostick, which established the right of the police essentially to stop people for no reason and ask them if they could search their property. And this case had to do with a man on a bus trip going through Florida, stopped by the state highway patrol looking for drugs. So on and on, Florida has been this kind of key state that's punitive. It has high incarceration rates. And if you look at, you know, where people are incarcerated in the United States, these large states account for a huge number of incarcerated folks. So New York, California, Texas, and Florida. In addition to sparking these legal precedents and national conversations on criminal justice, Florida is a key political state. So the Sun Belt has had more and more influence in our national politics, and which means that national policymakers really look to both the constituents and the policymakers and the policies coming out of these states, and they act as model legislation sometimes for national policy. So this is true, for example, in the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act in the mid-1990s, which severely curtailed the ability of prisoners to bring lawsuits against departments of corrections for conditions violations, for example. That federal law in part came about because of legislators in places like Texas and Florida who had been dealing with prison litigation against their own departments of corrections and wanted to stem that tide, right? Wanted to create more hurdles for prisoners to get through before they could actually sue the state. So all of these things make Florida a really great case study.
So in chapter one, you say there's no such thing as a clean historical slate. So I was hoping you could sort of set the stage for us in terms of carceral capacity, the carceral state, federalization of crime control.
Sure. Yeah. So this book really makes, I think, four key contributions. And the first one is to center actors' choices and decisions. So the common story that we are maybe familiar with around mass incarceration is one that's popularized by Michelle Alexander and the New Jim Crow, which is that there is a direct line between slavery, Jim Crow, and mass incarceration as forms of racial social control. And Another is a story about the politics of crime, that particularly conservatives and Republicans in the 1960s marshaled crime as a way of catalyzing white racial resentment in the support for Republican candidates and policies. But one of the things that both of those accounts don't really get at is who are the people who are making these decisions, and particularly making the decision to build what I call carceral capacity. And so one of the premises of the book is that we couldn't incarcerate this many people. We couldn't have one in 100 folks behind bars if we hadn't built not only the prisons to hold them, but the entire infrastructure of the criminal justice system. So the human and material and bureaucratic resources, right, dedicated to detecting, apprehending, processing, and punishing people deemed criminal. So this includes, you know, our police, our courts, our jails and our prisons, probation systems, parole systems, but also all the infrastructure around that. And so the book really looks at these actors' decisions to build state capacity, how they came about, and then what their effects are. And then in terms of how they came about, the kind of the third and fourth contribution is to look at the interaction of national and state politics and policy. So I think you mentioned federalism or federalization of crime control. One of the other things that we need to understand is that our criminal justice system is extremely decentralized. We have thousands of local police departments. We have, county systems of criminal justice and law enforcement. And then we have each state operating as a separate system. At the same time, what's happened at the national level in terms of politics and policy has influenced the states in a fairly uniform manner. And so while each state may have different cultures and histories that influence their policies and their politics, the national story does matter. And so one of the things in the book that I do is weave that state and national story together. And then finally, the last contribution is to see race as a cause of these penal policy decisions. So by centering actors' choices and decisions, I'm trying to understand, what is the role of race? How do we tease out the social mechanisms that race and racism become causes of the carceral state in a way that, as sociologists, I think kind of help us understand the carceral state a little bit better. So just to reiterate, when you to go back to your question about this idea of history, right? That what I argue is that the buildup of the prison state is a developmental process that we need to look at history to understand how actors and particularly policymakers made decisions to build carceral capacity, right? So this is what I mean when I say there's no kind of historical clean slate, right? People are always acting with regard to what's happened in the past. And that's a big part of the story I tell, is this buildup in carceral capacity and how that then changed the politics and policy that were possible moving forward.
Great. So I want to get back to something you mentioned in terms of racialized punishment. And in the book, in chapter two, you tie this back to the civil rights era. And it's been interesting to read this book in tandem with also, I'm currently reading Martin Luther King's autobiography. And so I was hoping you could set this historical stage for us.
Yes, of course. So the first period of real comprehensive building of carceral capacity that I tell is a story from the 1960s and 1970s. But to really understand that story, we need to go back further and understand that, particularly in the South, but in other places as well, the criminal justice system was a means of racial social control. It's part of the reason that the decentralized nature of the criminal justice system stayed decentralized for so long, was that it allowed local communities to use the criminal justice system kind of as they saw fit. And this became increasingly clear in the public imagination during the civil rights movement as civil rights activists, both Black and white, went down the South or organized themselves in the South to fight Jim Crow. And we see the pictures of law enforcement beating up on protesters. We see the use of jails, right, to put protesters in, and real kind of collusion that had been going on for decades between county sheriffs and local police. This kind of came to a head, as it were, in the 1960s and became a problem, right? Both in terms of for the civil rights movement, but also for reformers in some of these states, particularly states like Florida, which was growing in population at the time, was trying to market itself as a tourist destination. The national news of, you know, police brutality did not look good. And so beginning in the late 1950s, one of the things that Florida reformers tried to do was to centralize and bureaucratize and provide some form of accountability over local criminal justice agencies, right? So they started to provide training for police officers and minimum standards for hiring and education of law enforcement. This also included creating a new state bureaucracy to run the Department of Corrections. So I think we now take state bureaucracies in some way. We assume their existence, but some of them were created not so long ago. And they were created in part to rein in the use of the criminal justice system as a means of racial social control. And reformers in Florida during the 1960s were helped in significant part by federal investments in the criminal justice system. So at the national level, there was a move to invest in local law enforcement and state criminal justice systems, in part to deal with the urban unrest that was happening throughout the country in the late 1960s, but in part, again, to provide more training and more bureaucratization and more coordination among criminal justice agencies. So this was a huge moment of reform and investment in the in carceral capacity. And I think what we often miss is that there were progressive motivations for this investment at the time to make the criminal justice system actually more fair. And so one key story that I tell, for example, is the reformer in the Florida Department of Corrections. His name was Louis Wainwright. He was a good old boy from Northern Florida. But when he took over the Department of Corrections in the 1960s, his main goal was actually to provide more community-based options for corrections. So he built new community correction centers. He introduced new education programming. And he was very clear that he wanted to rid the institution of some of the segregation practices that had happened in the past. So in the 1950s, for example, it was only select white inmates that were getting education. And so he instituted programming kind of across the board. And so many things that we would think of as progressive criminal justice policies today really spread throughout the department in the 1970s, even during this time when we think of, oh, this is when incarceration rates started rising. But part of the reason that incarceration rates started rising were these investments into the police forces, to courts, and to that infrastructure that allowed more policing and processing of those that we deemed criminal. And so that was the key kind of period of carceral capacity buildup was in the 1960s and 1970s.
So then you get into the 1970s and prison overcrowding. And so here you examine a lot of legal language, and I was hoping you could tell us more about that.
Sure. So when I was investigating and doing my research for this book, and I started to talk to people, one of the things that people involved in decision-making kept telling me is, oh, the federal government or the federal courts told us we needed to build new prisons. And I heard it again and again. And knowing a little bit about the federal courts and prison conditions litigation, I was pretty sure that the courts didn't really say you have to build new prisons. And so one of the things I did was try to understand why policymakers, particularly by the early 90s, understood the courts to say you have to build prisons. And so this stems from a prisoner conditions litigation, a class action that was filed in the early 1970s, Costello v. Wainwright. It was not so different from other class action prison conditions lawsuits across the country, particularly in southern states. Southern state prisons have been particularly underfunded, in part because of the racialized nature of prisons, right? If we imagined in prisons to be where, African-American criminals were being held, then there was not a lot of support for funding those prisons. The idea was that prisoners should work to sustain prisons. And so what you had were prison conditions, you know, in some places that looked like plantations, in other places that looked like, kind of terrible factories, right? And in Florida, what you had was extreme overcrowding. The difference in the Florida lawsuit in the 1970s is that Louis Wainwright recognized that the lawsuit could actually help him. It could help the department get the resources that it needed to implement the vision that he had for corrections, right, which included rehabilitation programs. So he wanted to see the overcrowding end as much as anyone, really. And so he embraced the lawsuit as a way of kind of, you know, kicking the legislature and saying, hey, you know, we need these resources. The legislators at the time, however, both conservatives and more liberals, really did not want to invest resources in prisons. They had other priorities for the state, and they really fought against the lawsuit up through the early 1980s when they finally reached a consent decree with the federal court, which said that they would maintain a particular capacity per prison, so an actual square foot, you know, square footage per prisoner. And this was all spelled out in legal language. Now, so it's important in that document that it does not say the state needed to build new prisons, right? It didn't actually tell the state how to maintain this capacity per prisoner. It just said, you know, this is what you have to do. And so in the early 1980s, there was actually an attempt to slow prison admissions. Legislators came together with the lawyers in the Costello litigation. They worked to pass sentencing guidelines. They actually put in the legislation a decrease in the incarceration rate as a goal. They came up with alternatives to incarceration, and they really tried to sell this to the public as a way of both reducing crime, but also reducing the expense of incarceration. But this then led to the second key investment in prison building in Florida, which happened in the late 1980s. So at the same time that Florida legislators were trying to reduce incarceration, President Reagan and the Reagan administration began the war on drugs and started committing a lot of resources and public airtime to the scourge of drugs. And so the war on drugs, particularly after 1986, just kind of spiked arrests for drug crimes in Florida, particularly for African-American offenders. This led to an increase in prosecutions for drug crimes and admissions to prisons. And so in the middle of this attempt to reduce the prison population and deal with overcrowding, you had this spike in prison admissions. And at the time, Floridians elected Governor Bob Martinez, and he was only the second Republican governor who had been elected since 1884 in Florida, so since Reconstruction. And so Republicans here in Florida were trying to kind of make their mark. It's different from Democrats. And Governor Martinez decided that instead of trying to reduce the prison population, the best way to deal with this was to build new prisons. But he had a problem. He had to convince legislators that that it was worth building new prisons, that it was worth the commitment of state resources. And so his strategy was twofold. Was one to send letters to legislators telling them that the courts would make the state release prisoners if they didn't build prisons. And these letters would include sort of the specific criminals and crimes that they had committed that would be coming back to these legislators' communities. The second strategy was to start advertising prisons as economic development in rural communities. And so in the archives, I found letters going both ways to rural communities, talking about the benefits to rural communities. Prisoners create work squads that can go out and do things in the community. And then letters back from rural chambers of commerce asking for prisons in their communities. And so when I interviewed, for example, the Secretary of Corrections during that time, he told me that, and I'll quote here, he said, they put me in the middle sometimes. He's talking about these rural communities, sometimes trying to choose you or you. But actually, we needed all of them. I told them, just be patient. We will get to you, too. And so ultimately, the legislature built 15 new prisons in a matter of 5 or so years and added another 25 prison extensions or work camps during the late 1980s and early 1990s. And so this was this represented an almost a doubling of the capacity of the Florida Department of Corrections. Meanwhile, thousands of drug offenders languished in prisons, and perhaps even more importantly, I argue that it created a new politics of crime control. So this investment in prison capacity then allowed victims organizations and law enforcement organizations and legislators to use political to use prison capacity as a political resource to get tough on crime, right? And that this was a strategy of both Republicans and Democrats going into the 1990s. So that's the long story of the prison conditions litigation.
So this leads into what you call the turning point. The carceral state, which is a period of 1991 to 1995. And this includes something that you talked about earlier, which are early releases. So I was hoping you could tell us more.
Yeah, sure. So one of the key things that I try to do in the book is show that mass incarceration was not inevitable, that there were moments in time in which people really talked about doing something different and could have made different choices. And then I try to understand why we kept making these choices to invest in carceral capacity. And so the early 1990s is one of those periods. In the early 1990s, the war on drugs, or at least the rhetoric around the war on drugs, was winding down. And I show this by looking at how it comes up in newspaper articles in Florida. And you can see a marked decrease in the early 1990s. In addition, Florida had built enough prisons to satisfy the federal courts that the prisons were not overcrowded anymore. And that they were providing adequate health care in the prisons, which was another big part of the lawsuit. And then in addition, by the early 1990s, it became abundantly clear that the war on drugs and the buildup in carceral capacity had disproportionately impacted African Americans. And so there were a number of national studies and studies in Florida that showed that statistic that we often hear, sort of 1 in 3 African-American males between the ages of 18 and 26 are under some control of, under the supervision of the criminal justice system, right? That's a statistic from the early 1990s. And so there was a moral imperative, particularly, I argue, for the Democratic Party, who had, embraced the civil rights movement as part of their legacy, right? excuse me. And so There was this moment in the early 1990s in Florida where particularly Black legislators, with the help of a new governor, Democratic governor, Governor Lawton Childs, began to question some of the laws that had been passed during the kind of war on drugs frenzy. And these included mandatory minimum sentencing laws and habitual offender laws that kept people in prison for long periods of time, but that were also used by prosecutors as hammers to create more favorable plea bargaining positions for prosecutors. And so Lawton Childs originally was very supportive of these efforts and talked about not wanting to spend more money on prisons. He really wanted to invest particularly in healthcare for children in the state. Eventually, however, the politics of crime control and the politics of early release changed these political calculations. And so what happened is that built into some of the reform of the 1980s was a stipulation that if the Department of Corrections got too overcrowded, that people, defendants or prisoners would be given a few days off of their sentences and essentially be released from prison early. Now, again, people were, what amounted to a few days per month off a sentence really sort of added up over time. And so you had the media in the early 1990s begin to report on Florida prisoners who were only serving about a third of their sentences. And so this became a big story for the media. And it was something that was picked up by law enforcement who really wanted to keep investing in prisons. And you also have to remember that in the early 1990s, fortunately, we were at kind of the peak of crime. We now know that it was the peak, that crime rates have been going down actually since the early 1990s. But of course, at the time, we didn't know that, and policymakers didn't know that. And so Jeb Bush, as a gubernatorial candidate, came out and said, Lawton Childs is soft on crime and doesn't want to build more prisons. And, I propose building, I forget how many it was, prisons for 25,000 new prison beds. And what was amazing to see in the historical record was how quickly Governor Lawton Childs reversed course and immediately countered with his own proposal for prison beds. Was supported by a victims' rights movement that had been essentially started by the Sheriffs and Prosecutors Association. And he was supported, of course, by law enforcement. And the story I tell here is a story in which those communities most affected by crime, particularly urban Black neighborhoods, those voices weren't really heard in the state conversation about what to do about crime and where to put resources. It was a pretty one-sided conversation at the state level. We need to build more prisons in order to protect crime victims. Whereas the victims of crime at the community level, and particularly Black victims of crime, talked about more resources for education, more resources for treatment, better policing, right? Less police brutality, and so on. And so this is also a story of the way in which our political system disenfranchises some groups in just the structure of how policy is made at the state level. So again, to go back to your question, that's one way, one time in which there was different decisions that could have been made in the early 1990s, but eventually this state legislators decided to commit more resources to building prisons.
So you mentioned that crime starts to fall in the 90s and it continues to fall, but there's increasing pressure to put on prisons to use tough justice, which you argue puts more folks at risk of incarceration. So here in Chapter 6, you turn your eye to policymakers. So I was hoping you could tell us what you found out here.
Sure. So one of the questions I had also going into this project was, you know, as sociologists, there's a long tradition in the sociology of punishment, which is to say, you know, the link between crime and punishment is rather tenuous, right? There's all of these other political and social considerations that go into incarceration or prisons. There's not a direct link between crime and incarceration. But you know, by some point, you know, by the early 2000s, there's a way in which crime rates have been going down for a decade. Nationally, there's a different conversation happening, right? Post 2001, September 11th, there's a conversation about terrorism, right? And not so much about domestic crime. And yet, this was actually a time when I was in Florida doing my fieldwork around 2006 and 2007, or at least starting to do my fieldwork. And I was surprised at the extent to which the governor was still sort of using the politics of crime to get elected, even though this was not something that seemed to be something that his constituency or any constituency really at the state level was calling for. And so particularly here, I am referring to the governorship of Charlie Crist. Now, Charlie Crist is an interesting character. So he started his political career as a state legislator, and he made a name for himself by, and this was in the mid-1990s, he made a name for himself by single-handedly bringing back chain gangs to the state of Florida. He got himself on criminal justice committees and was able to convince his fellow legislators to pass a bill that would require the Department of Corrections to come up with a way of putting prisoners to work in the community in a very public way in chains, right? So this was a part of this get tough on crime move in the 1990s, which was not just about getting tough on crime, but getting tough on those we deem to be criminal offenders, both in prisons and outside of prisons. And so the newspapers gave Charlie Crist the nickname of Chain Gang Charlie, which he kind of wore with pride. And he was the ultimate politician. So after state legislator, he ran for, I'm not even going to remember the order in which this happened, attorney general, and then governor again, until he finally, was elected as governor. But his entire, almost a huge part of his campaign in the early 2000s was about passing something that he called the Anti-Murder Act, which, you know, the name just sort of in a way says it all, because who is really for murder, right? But this was the Anti-Murder Act, and it was in response to a number of murders of, you know, very brutal murders of young white children, girls, in fact, who had been killed by folks. So, defendants who were out on probation or parole at the time. And so what the Anti-Murder Act did was say that anyone who violated probation, who had been convicted of these crimes, would be immediately sent back to prison. So it made prison the kind of default for probation violations. What was interesting is that by this time, it had started to become clear to the legislature that prisons were costing the state a lot. And so he received, for the first time in, you know, many years, some pushback from the legislature about this bill. And so they kept narrowing the bill until finally he could kind of claim a political victory with the passage of the bill when he first became governor. And so what was sort of amazing to me was the stickiness of what I call the carceral ethos, which is this idea that that politicians need to be tough on crime, that constituencies will support them being tough on crime, or more importantly, punish them for being soft on crime. And that what being tough on crime means is essentially putting more people behind bars for longer periods of time. Acting as though they're disposable. And once they're behind bars, not really thinking about what they're doing there or the consequences of their imprisonment. So that's the story I tell about kind of the consequences of the tough on crime movement of the 1990s, was it really carries through as crime declines into the 21st century.
Yeah, so then you bring us to the present day and you talk about sort of longer term consequences of this penal system over time. So I was hoping you could bring us up to speed to 2016.
Sure. Yeah. So you may be aware that there has been talk now of reform and trying to reduce prison populations or to bring programming back into prisons and this kind of thing. And this really started as a fiscal concern. As a consequence of the 2008 recession, state lawmakers became more and more aware that of the extent to which corrections or prisons were eating up the state budget. So, for example, the current governor of Florida, Governor Rick Scott, when he was campaigning in 2011, he talked about, or I'll quote him, he says, "We are spending billions of tax dollars locking people up and getting very little value on the dollar. 66% of those incarcerated will be back within 3 years, and we'll have to pay for that too." So the emphasis is very much is on the cost of the system and the ineffectiveness of the system. And you can hear this type of language from many different sides of the political aisle at this point. What I think people are less aware of, and I hope my book exposes a little bit more, is that corrections in Florida have been underfunded at least since 1999, when Jeb Bush became governor. During that time, From 1999 to when Governor Scott takes over as governor, there had been a sort of drastic curtailment of inmate programs in the prisons. Healthcare had deteriorated. Officers were promoted with records of who had records of violence against inmates. The office of the Inspector General in the Department of Corrections had been gutted. There was corruption. Corrections officer turnover was high and pay was low. In fact, the starting salaries for corrections officers in Florida ranked next to last among the 10 largest prison systems in the country. And so this resulted in prison brutality against prisoners in the Florida Department of Corrections. And so the story I tell in the last substantive chapter of the book is this. These two policy problems. On one hand, this the amount we spend more generally on corrections, and then on the other hand, prison brutality and the deteriorating conditions of prisons. And these are intricately linked and create an issue for reformers whose main argument is the expense of prisons, because one way to deal with the expense of prisons is to underfund prison and make them unsafe places to be. It's like we're going back to the 1960s and 1970s in terms of these prison conditions. I was amazed again doing my research in a way how little national attention the conditions of state prisons are getting these days. The Miami Herald has done an amazing job of investigative reporting on these issues, particularly this. The newest round of reporting, starting in about 2014, began with the death of a prisoner named Darren Rainey, who was in a facility meant for mentally ill prisoners. And he was essentially scalded to death in a hot shower by corrections officers who still have not been brought to, accountability for that crime. Given this, the sort of terrible conditions and the cost, one of the things that I investigate or talk about in the book is the way in which the feedback effects of the carceral state and this investment in carceral capacity makes change extremely difficult. So the politics of crime is alive and well. Governors still feel the need to have law enforcement standing behind them, in their campaigns and during their governorship. The structure of the criminal justice system makes it very hard to change. The decentralized nature, the layered nature of all of the laws that we've passed in the past three or four decades. elected law enforcement, elected prosecutors and sheriffs who have a stake in maintaining carceral capacity. Rural communities whose livelihoods in some way depend upon the prisons located there have in some places effectively fought closing prisons in their communities. And so all of these things combine to make change extremely difficult. And so one of the things that I argue moving forward is that we need more than reform. We need more than kind of tinkering at the margins.
Great. So here I was hoping you could give us the big takeaways from your book and also talk about what you call a new and just ethos.
So The big takeaway that I want people to leave with, having read the book or listened to this podcast, is this idea of partial capacity, that one of the key reasons we find ourselves in the position today as the highest incarcerator in the world is our investment in carceral capacity. That is the material and human resources needed to detect, apprehend, process, and detain those people we find criminal. And this spans, you know, everything from policing to prisons and even larger than that. And so understanding that we've made those investments in carceral capacity instead of other types of investments that we could have made. In fact, investments that we know reduce the potential of criminal offending. Investments in early childhood education, for example. Investments in nurse visits to vulnerable mothers and children. So things like that. And so this then leads us into a conversation about how do we reform? And one of my key takeaways here is to say we want to understand that anytime we create new things, new programs around the criminal justice system, that creates consequences and that creates interest groups. And so I argue that what we need to do is de-invest in carceral capacity, rein in that that spending, and invest in things that are completely outside of the criminal justice system. So, and then finally, in terms of a new ethos, the other thing that we need for reform is a new idea of what justice should look like. For so long, at least long in terms of, you know, contemporary criminal justice, you know, the last 30 or 40 years, our idea has been, well, the more prisons, the more punitive, the better. And we're starting a reform effort without really having a new ethos of justice. What should criminal justice look like? What should it do? What is the purpose of these systems that we have or systems that we are creating? And so that's the conversation that I want us to start to have, and I hope this book will prompt.
Great. So today we've been talking with Heather Schoenfeld about her book, Building the Prison State, Race and the Politics of Mass Incarceration. What are you working on now, Heather?
Thank you. So my new project is also focused at state level policy and politics. And it is in collaboration with Michael Campbell, who is at the University of Denver and someone who I have collaborated with before. And we are looking at states' ability to pass laws that do reduce their prison population and carceral capacity. And so some states, like New Jersey, for example, have seen a marked decrease in their prison population since 2008 or earlier. So New York, New Jersey. Other states are just now passing some, you know, fairly significant reforms. So we are yet to see the effects of states like Georgia, for example. But then some states are very much holding on to the status quo, Florida being one of them. And so we are doing a case comparison of states that are making progress, states that are making less progress, and trying to understand the people and the institutions and the policies that are coming together to create some progress in this area to significantly reduce prison populations. So it's an NSF funded project that is just in its early stages.
Sounds like a cool project.
Thanks.
Well, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Sarah. I appreciate it.